Number two of the August 16th, 2005 interview with Professor Harold Schoig.
So the second year that I was there, I was able to get around. I was more in control of what I was teaching, and so I was able to do a little bit more traveling. I saw a lot of Uganda. I remember the Karamojong people in the north, visited them, these fascinating traditions of cattle people who would roam the countryside with their cattle, and had traditions that really fascinated me. And I had read a book that had said that the British had destroyed the traditional life of the Karamojong. And it certainly wasn't evident to me. I learned pretty fast that you don't destroy traditions that easily. That the traditions were still intact. That doesn't mean that they weren't influenced by the British, but the traditions were not destroyed. I think that colonialism had a devastating impact on Africa in many respects, and I think that there's no question but that. The European traditions worked their way into Africa, no question about that. But that doesn't mean that the traditional beliefs and values of the people were destroyed. I don't think that happens to people. I don't think that can happen to people. So I saw a lot of Uganda. I went to went down to what was then Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, and went to the Houses of Parliament down there and saw Ian Smith and some of these early, yeah, it was really quite fascinating. It was then Salisbury, it wasn't Harare, then it was called Salisbury, the main city. And so I went to, saw a lot about the northern part of Zimbabwe, the Shona of Rhodesia, the Shona people. I would come back to Zimbabwe later in my life to do some very serious work, but then it was just went to Victoria Falls, did the tourist kind of things in Malawi, which was then Nyasaland. Went out in Lake Nyasa, and I remember seeing this incredible, just tiny little island out there with just a couple of trees, and on this island were these. It looked like something out of folklore, these dragon-like creatures. What are they called? And they also have them in Indonesia. And I wondered how on earth they lived. And it was explained to me that the birds would be eating fish and go up into the trees and eat their fish. And as they were eating the fish, part of it would splash over and fall to the earth below. And that's the way these, what do they call these things? I forgot the name of these. They look like little dragons to me. Yeah, that sort of thing. Anyway, and so, did that sort of thing. Went to Dar es Salaam in what was then Tanzania now. And with the excitement in Tanzania of Nyerere now becoming the leader and something called Ujamaa being the philosophy, where meaning we're people are struggling together to create this new world. It was such an exciting time in East Africa. That there was such hope among the people that everything was going to change. Uganda, this tiny little landlocked country, dependent on tobacco, sugar cane, that sort of thing, plantains, it was a small country. It was a poor country, but it was fertile, fairly fertile. The northern part was kind of tough, and there were harbingers of what was still to happen, terrible things that were going to happen. And when I would go further north in Uganda, I saw all these places where people spilling over from Sudan, including Darfur, were living because of trouble, even in the early 60s.
Even then.
And then in the...
That's 40 years ago.
Yeah, and in the other part, down in the western, southwestern part of Uganda, tent cities of people spilling over from Rwanda because of the troubles that were going there, which would, of course, later become in both of those countries, genocide.
Yes.
But there, the elements were already there, and Uganda was housing them in effect. But Uganda also didn't know what it had in store, and that was Idi Amin,
right.
Who became this absolutely monstrous dictator. And AIDS was not heard of yet. AIDS would decimate Uganda. Uganda's in pretty good shape now, as far as conquering AIDS is concerned. It's still there, don't get me wrong. But then, initially, it was devastating. And people used it, the politicians, just like they did in this country, a political kind of a thing. You know, they refused to acknowledge it, you know, just like in Mbeki in South Africa. And so that gives it a time to really get a foothold, and it really, it really had whole communities were, you know, were divested of young people. It was old people and children. So, but that was yet to come. That didn't happen during my period there. The year, when I still remember independence, what's a place called Hoima for the near Masindi for the celebrations. Learned the national anthem. It was so exciting. The kids, I remember the kids, we had the kids give speeches, and they were so filled with hope about what was going to happen. And that infused the classroom activities too. It touched, it was woven into the excitement these kids understood how important this, their education was going to be to them.
Do you remember, did you have some students who were so bright that they really stood out?
Yeah, always, of course. And there were some really excellent students. And there were students who were having a rough time, who were still having a rough time with English, for example. But others, no, who were just very bright and who had very definite ideas about what they were going to do. Almost to a student, their ideas were that they were going to help to create this new Uganda. And so it was an enormous amount of hope. And that's with the people. Second year, I also got to get into the countryside more. School kids used to take me home to visit their parents. And here's where this really did change my life, my career completely. Because still with Beowulf, sort of in the back of my mind, the kids take me home. And I learned how really rich the oral tradition in Africa is. And so it begins to sort of percolate in my mind that what I want to do for my PhD and for my teaching career is African oral traditions, because it was so rich. And then I started reading the stuff that had been collected, became aware of epics in Africa and things like that. And I still wasn't conversant with languages yet, so I knew I had a lot of work to do. But I was enough aware, and going and hearing these stories, how really rich the tradition is. So that's something that began to happen during that second year, and it began to shape some ideas in my mind. But at the same time, I was the only later on another American came to work in the school in the second year. The first year, the British would have nothing to do with me in this community. I was an American. They thought that America was responsible for the coming independence in Uganda. And I remember thinking to myself, I really wish we were, but we weren't, definitely not. But they really saw me as an interloper. They thought they were going to be in Uganda forever, and their whole careers were going to be in Uganda. And here, when I got there, and within a year, they were going to be hauled back to England. They were not happy. It was a typical colonial kind of a situation in Masindi, this tiny little town, not even a town, community. The Boma, which was the highest part of the town, we're right on the equator now. They had is where the British would live. They had their homes up there. This was the best parcels of land and so forth, and they had their European club up there. I was never invited to the European Club. I think I went a couple of times. Not that I really wanted to go, but they really didn't have much to do with me at all. The Africans went to the club only because they were the houseboys, you know, as they called them, who worked for the British in the clubs. The British would retire to the club at night, have their sundowners, and bemoan their fate, you know. They had a big golf course, for heaven's sake. Everything was tended by these houseboys, gardeners, and so forth. It was just amazing. I remember some of the women, the British women, when they walked, they would jingle. And because that what caused them to jingle is they had this big a set of keys attached to their waist. Everything was locked. The coffee jars were locked. The liquor cabinet was locked. Everything in the house was locked because the idea was that you can't trust these Africans. They'll steal you blind. So they had no respect for Africans at all. And so every morning, the wife would typically get up, unlock everything, take out potatoes and everything that's needed for the day's meals, and then lock everything up again. And then it was up to the maid to deal with this food for the day. And when they drank, I remember some of them, when they would drink liquor, they would always put a mark on the liquor jar, the liquor bottle, to, you know, so that if somebody was stealing, they would be aware of this. So the idea that these people were living in an environment where they didn't trust at all the Africans around them, and they had very little regard for them, you know, intellectually, and they, you know, they wouldn't hear of this idea that these kids could ever be, you know, of the intellectual quality of the white kids. And that's another reason why the educational system was the way it was. Put it on the board, memorize it. They're good at memory, these kids, would be the big idea. You know, they can memorize it and they'll get along with that. So these colonial people, these were real typical, you know, from what I heard of colonials elsewhere in Africa, they seem to be typical colonials. They had very little respect for Africans and for African traditions and so forth, and felt that when the whites left, it would all collapse. And that's why you would, you know, in the early days in Congo and Uganda and places, when things did go wrong, you had all these whites around the world saying, "I told you so, I told you so, I told you so," you know. So there was that, and that was an interesting thing to me. I mean, it didn't bother me much, you know, because these people were passé as far as I was concerned. I was a part of the new Uganda. I was helping the new Uganda, so it was an interesting historical thing for me to be there that year. They many of them stayed on in the second year, but when colonialism was still, they didn't call it they didn't call Uganda a colony. They called it a protectorate. Which was meant to be a different classification from a colony, but it was pretty much, I didn't know, when I went to Kenya, which was a colony, I couldn't tell much difference between the two. I got to get around, I got around a lot in Eastern Africa, so I got to see a lot of Kenya and Tanzania. Uganda, Churchill called Uganda the jewel in Africa's crown, and I understand why. It was just a gorgeous place. The mountains, what was then Murchison Falls, where the Nile River, you know, fell down great heights, and crocodiles would be waiting below, waiting for fish that were stunned by the drop, so they could get an easy meal. Crocodiles, hippos, they were all there, and but there was also this burgeoning new country that was being born, and so today, the animal life. It's very much restricted to the reserves, and much of it is destroyed now. Rhino life is almost all gone. Elephants are in pretty bad shape. But, you know, a lot of this was a necessary kind of a transition to the changes that were taking place. Okay. So all these, you know, the love of teaching, the excitement about the country, undergoing change, the British in the background, the headmaster who couldn't stand my guts, and the one British headmaster then later on gave way to another British headmaster, I remember. But you know, we remained about, I think at the height there were five teachers there, So it never became a very big school. I think that it's still, I just talked to some people here who were here in Madison the other day, some Ugandans who are were talking about the AIDS situation in Uganda. And from what they say about Masindi, it's a growing community. So I hope it is. I have just great memories of the place.
Did you ever go back there after you left?
No. What happened was, when I wanted to go back to Africa to do research, I wanted to go back to Uganda. And I was going to learn the language. But Idi Amin was in control. The State Department put Uganda out of off limits to Americans. So I was not able to go back to Uganda. But that's another story. I'll talk about that in a little while. When I left Uganda,
and you had only been sent there for 2 years.
2 years, and that was it. And you know, it was, the thing is, it was really like the Peace Corps. And we like to think, those of us who are in it, and we, by the way, we still keep in contact. They have a regular newsletter and so forth. We like to think that we influenced Kennedy on the Peace Corps. This is the first big group of Americans ever to go, and it was pretty successful. Mm-hmm. You know, not that we were doing anything spectacular. We were teaching. One of the things that some of the people really put me off, because they also felt that they were going to be, you know, propagandizing America and so forth, and I wasn't interested in that. I remember calling somebody in the United States once, and in order to do that, there was one phone in Masindi, and had to go to that phone, and we had to, in order to, I was calling somebody in Ann Arbor, I remember, and had to sort of line up, you know, to make the phone call. So the thing is, we were remote, we didn't have electricity. And another thing that I learned was, and I think I'd learned this earlier, was, you know, I really didn't need all that stuff, all the accoutrements. I got along with a minimum amount of clothing and with food that was, you know, it was as far as I was concerned, it was fine. Some people complained about the food, but I didn't have any trouble with that. You know, this, as I said earlier, came from, you know, I go to Chicago as a kid to, you know, to play the game of eating food and all that sort of thing, and found that that really wasn't it at all. It was, you know, it was just a fabrication. And so food was, you know, I ate the staple foods, matoke, they called it, which was taking plantains, which are these bananas that are not sweet, and they sort of have the consistency when you mash them up of potatoes. And I couldn't have dealt with that alone because it's very dry, but then you put bean sauce over it, and it's very palatable. And, you know, a lot of vegetables and fruits that you grew yourself. So, you know, I got along very well with that. I was becoming, I guess, more and more opinionated as time went on. So I think I gave my fellows a difficulty from time to time. But you know, it was just for me, it was another one of those experiences, just like the Air Force, another one of those experiences where, you know, shaping was continuing. And I kind of liked that. I liked it. It was enjoyable. I knew that it was having an impact upon me. You know, I kept regular contact with my parents, because my parents were very worried about my going to Africa, because they had all these ideas about Africa. When my parents died, I found the letters that I had been writing, and I've been reading those over. And I was really trying to convince them, you know, that these are people. That's all. They're just people, just like you and me. They're no different. And you know, I remember when I was getting on the plane to go to Colombia at the beginning. My parents were there, and they really were just not. I think that they accepted it. I was by that time pretty independent, and I pretty, you know, going my own way. But I don't think that they fully understood this. I don't know if they ever did, but I did try in my letters, you know, to communicate this to them. I met missionaries, Christian missionaries there from America and from Europe, and And I could get along with missionaries as long as they were not of the opinion that they had the only answers. I had enough of that when I was in grade school, that that these Africans were going to die, you know, and go to hell forever because they weren't Christian. You know, one of the things that happened in Uganda, as you're going up to Masindi, it was almost as if on one side of the highway, this was reserved for the Protestant Christian missionaries, and on the other side for the Catholic Christian. They had sort of carved up the country, the way Europe carved up Africa in 1885, you know, when what they called the Scramble for Africa. So some of the missionaries, I thought, were quite splendid, but others, I really was turned off by them because of this attitude that, that they had the only answers, this true believer kind of an idea. And I also couldn't handle missionaries, or anybody else for that matter, who were paternalistic, you know, who seemed to be, you know, have nice ideas about Africans, but only in the sense that we're reaching down and we're lifting them up. And as long as they stay within the context that I have created, everything is going to be fine. By the way, same thing that happened among liberals in this country with blacks in the 1960s. We'll get to that shortly. So, you know, I that's the case with some of my fellow teachers as well. Although the teachers were by and large pretty young, and they weren't as sort of molded as some of those missionaries were. So I became very dubious. I had, when I was a kid, we would sing songs once a year on Mission Sunday about how where Africa's golden mountains roll down, their golden sands or something like that, and about how the Rudyard Kipling idea about the white man's burden and all that sort of thing, you know, and a lot of people still had that idea, and I didn't have to be divested of that idea because I don't think I had it when I went, but there were plenty of people around there who did, and plenty of people who still have it to this day. I love Kampala, big, not a huge city, but an interesting city. At that time, and in Masindi as well, many of the shops were owned by Indians, people from India, and Idi Amin kicked them all out of the country in a very vicious kind of a way. Remember, this is the Uganda of Entebbe, you know, where the the Israeli experience was. Entebbe was outside Kampala, it was where the airport was. But essentially Uganda is a country of farmers, and you know, and they're trying to make it, and they have years of drought when they really have trouble, and then they have the good years when everybody is in a dancing kind of a mood, and so I was able to participate in all of this, and again, fumbling around with the language, going to the market and buying things, and knowing enough of Lunyoro Rutoro so that I was able to buy things in the marketplace, I enjoyed that, but most of all, the classroom and working with these young kids who were so excited about the world that they were about to create.
Was this the first foreign language you were learning, or had you learned one of the European languages?
No, I did study French when I was in Michigan, and again to get mainly a reading knowledge of French. When I went to Paris, I was one of those Americans that the French, you know, loved to caricature, because, you know, my spoken French was and remains dreadful, because I've never really worked at a spoken language. I did work at spoken languages in Africa, but but no, I hadn't, and you know, I did French when I was at Michigan seriously enough so that I could read some of the literature. I wanted to do that. But no, at this time in Uganda, language was, I knew how important languages were, and it was sort of very much in my mind that I was going to have to come to terms with this somehow. Okay. I learned enough to get around, but it really wasn't enough to really have intelligent conversations with people at that time. But this was, again, you know, this is late in my life. I mean, I can't be preparing myself for everything, you know, and my life is going back. I was in the Air Force, went to Michigan, now I'm in Uganda. And so I come back to the United States, very sadly leaving Uganda. But my future was now pretty much, pretty much ready to go. But the thing is, that while I was in Uganda, you know, there was no money. They paid you enough to live, but that was it. It was minimal wages, just like the Peace Corps, you know. And to mention again, it's shortly after I came back that Kennedy, or maybe during, that Kennedy went to Michigan and made the Peace Corps statement. There were three more groups of people in this Teachers for East Africa, they called it, TEA. But then the Peace Corps was beginning, and this sort of gave way to the Peace Corps. But when I came back to the United States, I had no money. And so there was no way I could do what I wanted to do, go to school. And so, and I wasn't quite sure whether I wanted to study oral traditions within the realm of social science, history, and anthropology, or as a part of literature, you know, of an art form. In any case, I came back, and so I went back to Valparaiso to teach. I taught there for two more years and saved money.
Had they saved a position
yeah.
for you?
Yeah, they were quite pleased with my going to Africa. And so it's two more years, which I enjoyed, and I was making $6,000 then. And then we're in the 60s, and the 60s is this exciting time when the whole of this country was in turmoil. Mm-hmm. And initially, first of all, it was the civil rights movement. Later on, it would also become the Vietnam movement. So when I was, all of these experiences I've had are having an impact upon me. And so what's happening now in the southern part of the United States is that a lot of college students are going down to the south, to Mississippi, to Alabama, and elsewhere, in order to help to help people to register to vote, because the whites were still making that very difficult for them. So I went down several times, and twice.
While you were at Valpo.
While I was at Valpo, and in the summer times, twice I took students down. At Freedom Summer, I took along with a couple of other teachers, but I was in charge. Took busloads of students down to do voter registration. It was real mechanical work. We had to go into the African-American areas, you know, which were outside the cities. I was in Birmingham, and go house to house, door to door, and encourage people to register to vote. In the evenings, we would go to downtown Birmingham and meet, and it was a very scary kind of a time. We were not welcome there. We were these invasion of northern college students. Mm-hmm. And so we would meet in a basement of some place, and we would then compile all the work that we had done, and sleep on floors and so forth. And the bus, I remember one of the buses, maybe the second time, was stopped. We stopped in Tennessee on the way down, and then they were going to stop for a rest stop, and then the bus driver decided we cannot stop, it's too dangerous, and we kept going. So when I was there, Viola Liuzzo from Michigan was killed.
Yes.
And then, of course, Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner in Mississippi were killed. So it's a very, very dangerous time. Taking students down there for me was an education for me. It was also an education for them.
Were you frightened?
Yeah, to a certain extent. Although I think most of the time, you know, the work was very steady and, you know, and important to do, but it wasn't, you know, talking to people who were very frightened, and some of them would not sign things and so forth, African Americans. It was scary in the evenings, especially, and driving from the outside, the suburban areas into downtown Birmingham was not fun. And then hearing about these other things that were happening, where people were being killed, you know, people just like us, and you know, that was kind of scary. But these young people, they really were keen to go. At one point, the president of Valparaiso University was disgusted with me and called me this white person on a charger or something like this, and sticking my nose into things. I made a lot of noise. What happened is. So this is one of those ironies. George Wallace was coming to Valpo to speak. And yeah, and there was a lot of consternation about this, and so the president decided that he would call off the speech. He wouldn't be allowed. And I was furious. So I said, fuck, this university stands for speech. He must be allowed to come here. We've got to speak to him. That's when he called me this white charger. And he wasn't. They didn't allow him to come. That infuriated me. I remember some years later, by the way, that the African Literature Association, after this happened, I would have nothing to do with them anymore. This is under apartheid, and it was in Chicago, I think, and they were having Nadine Gordimer, the Nobel Prize winner, winning writer, to come to speak, and they, to use their expression, they disinvited her. You know, here's a woman who put her career on the line regularly. She was in the front line. She wasn't in America. She was in South Africa. They banned her books in South Africa and so forth. We would not invite her because of the color of her skin. She was white, and therefore they would not invite her. That I quit. I just quit the ALA. I would have nothing to do with them anymore. And by the way, while on that subject, this is one of the things that I think the University of Wisconsin could have done and did not do. And that is when, this is getting ahead of the story, but it's in my mind, when the University of Cape Town, in Cape Town, was having an anniversary, a long, I don't know, 100, 150th anniversary, they were trying to get people...
Interview with Professor Harold Schoeb.
This is a university that was always in trouble with the government. The government was taking money away from them because they had, and I know this because I was there during apartheid, they allowed Africans to come to that school. It was supposed to be a purely white school. They had Africans in the classroom, and they had Indians in the classroom, and they had the so-called coloreds, which was an official mm-hmm. racial classification in South Africa. I thought, we really need to support them. We refused. We did not, because it was a university in South Africa, and I think that the university felt it was too dangerous for us to identify ourselves with an institution in South Africa. Whatever the reason, I thought that we should have, you know, these people deserved our support. And we didn't give it to them at a crucial moment. You know, apartheid was still very much in control at that time. I'd love to have seen this at this university, which is the first university in the United States. I remember this very well, that divested its money from companies that did business in South Africa.
Right.
And other universities followed suit, and Massachusetts followed us. But we were the pathfinders here, and I was so proud. I went to these meetings with the regents when speeches were made, urging them to have nothing to do with companies, big companies that did business with South Africa, and we divested, and it was wonderful. And here was an opportunity again to demonstrate that here's a university that's having a rough time. That university and University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, they did things, maybe in the big picture, it weren't quite as dramatic as they might have been. But given apartheid South Africa and the narrowness of that system of government, you know, it took a lot of guts to do what University of Cape Town and the University of Witwatersrand were doing. So I was disappointed that we didn't do that. But you know, people make choices, and you know, I also know that people see only the surface of things, and if they saw a University of Wisconsin connection with UCT, University of Cape Town. But now, in November of this year, the chancellor is taking a huge group of people down there, and they're opening up this telescope that they did in relation with South Africa and with two other countries to create this incredible, huge telescope in South Africa. So we're now having very close relations. We've always had pretty close relationships with them. But so that's, I think we fumbled the ball that time. But I think that generally, as we'll find out later on, we'll talk later on about that, the university has had good relations. This is certainly under Chancellor Shalala, and then continued right up until this time.
So we're back though at Valpo, and you're taking
that's
the
right.
students.
So
were you organizing that?
Yes.
Or it was not part of
no.
SNCC.
I organized it, but I connected it with a student nonviolent coordinating committee. Yeah, we had to, because and students were really worried about this, and some parents wouldn't let their children go because it was so dangerous. It was really a tough time. It was wonderful for the students. It was wonderful for me. I remember one of the time I went down by myself once to participate in the last legs of the march from Selma. And I still remember picking up the people on the march the night before the march into Montgomery, where Martin Luther King was to speak. Night before, Nina Simone singing Mississippi Goddamn, Peter Paul and Mary. It was a very exciting time. Hundreds of people by now. And we marched the next morning through the streets of Montgomery. And I still remember on the walls of the buildings as we were marching down the street, the huge buildings, people jeering us as we were marching, all these whites jeering us along the sideline. Huge pictures of Martin Luther King in pictures of him and anti-Vietnam people, because he had come out against the war in Vietnam, pictures of him with, quote, known communists, attempting to tar him. It was wonderful. People singing freedom songs, coming to this right downtown in Montgomery, where the state capitol is. I think that was by the state capitol. And then hearing this absolutely marvelous speech by Martin Luther King, and it was an incredible experience. And it was people from all over the United States who had come there. And, it wasn't, we all didn't march across the bridge, and so for that was a smaller group. But we picked it up at the end and participated in that march. That was very important to me as well. So it was either three or four times that I went down. I was in Mississippi once. And, of course, we're hearing of the... By this time, Rosa Parks is, almost saintly, as a person who took things into her own hands. The young people who sat at the bars in the 5 and 10 cent stores and things like this. So it was exciting, and really one had a feeling. There was no question. There was a headiness about this because you had the feeling that you were part of history. That history was being shaped here. And I was never a leader. I was a follower, but I was very happy to be a follower of that, to participate in this. So what that did was I think that the president breathed a sigh of relief when I finally left Valpo. But I was a troublemaker.
I suspect you were popular with the students.
I think that I had the respect of the students, I also had the sense that a lot of these young people were young people like I was when I was their age, who came from pretty tightly constricted homes, and who were now sort of blossoming, carefully, because their parents were still sending them to a Lutheran university, but at least they were, there was a movement outwards, and I liked that, that excited me. And I still hear from students from Valpo.
Really?
From Valparaiso, to this day. And in fact, Ken Fraser, the head of the library, his wife went to Valparaiso. I have good memories of that place. But I had to move on. So when I left, I still wasn't quite sure what I was going to do. But I got a fellowship to study Swahili at UCLA.
Who gave you the fellowship?
I can't remember now. I think it was National Endowment for the Humanities, but I can't remember exactly which one it was. But that was the summer of 1964, I think. And I like big cities, so I fell in love with Los Angeles. By the way, when I came back from Uganda, I did stop at various places in Europe. I fell in love with Italy. I love France, even with my lousy French, and of course England, because as an English major, it was just fun to go all over England. So that was very much in my veins, the lust for travel. So when I go to Los Angeles, I really love Los Angeles, but Los Angeles at that time was not a city for walkers. There were places where there weren't even sidewalks. Maybe there still are. You know, it was an automobile place. But I really did like it. And I liked the UCLA area. Studied Swahili. That summer was the summer of Watts. The suburb of Los Angeles and the explosion of Watts.
Yeah.
And I think that's, is it 64 or 65?
65.
Yeah. And I divided my time between studying Swahili, which we were supposed to immerse ourselves in, and going out to Watts. And from way up where UCLA was, where I had a little apartment near a veterans cemetery, I remember, and you could see the smoke coming up from Watts.
Uh-huh.
And I remember the chant, "Burn, baby, burn."
Uh-huh.
And I went down to Watts a number of times when I was there, and I knew a couple of people from Watts, and it was really the anger was palpable. Again, it's this unbroken continuity of African Americans making demands that their lives be changed. And parts of it were just ruined during that period. So I'm studying Swahili, going down to Watts, and trying to get as much of Los Angeles as I could packed into that summer. And then it was during that summer that I decided, okay, I'm going to make a decision. I'm going to study the oral traditions of Africa in a literary point of view. And I had a letter from this university from Philip Curtin, who was a major historian here of Africa at that time and was also involved in the development of an African Department of African Languages and Literature. It was just coming into being at that time. And this was, I got the letter from him. He invited me to come. I think I had the fellowship. This was a year fellowship. So the idea was I would transfer the fellowship from UCLA to Wisconsin.
How did he know of you?
Not quite sure how, as I think back on this, how connections were made.
Uh-huh.
But he invited me to come here. I would ultimately be the second a PhD graduate of this department. It was the only degree granting Department of African Languages and Literature in the country, still is. And
isn't that strange?
Yeah, Florida is now developing one, Gainesville. And one of the few outside Africa. And so it was just a new department. And I was, you know, I knew I was going to study African literature, but my special interest was African oral tradition because of my experiences in Uganda and going way back to my experiences with Beowulf. So I came here, but I immediately fell under the influence of A.C. Jordan, who was this political exile. He'd been at UCLA himself, he had taken what they called an exit visa from South Africa, where if you leave, you can never come back again. And he left with his family, wife and three kids, to he had a Carnegie grant, I think, or something, to study in England and then study in the United States. So he couldn't go back. And under apartheid anyway. And so he then came here to teach. He was attracted here. Then they brought a number of other people, one from England, one from New Zealand, I remember, one from France. It was quite an interesting group of people who set up this department, along with Philip Curtin and Jan van Sina. They both in the history department, but they're the ones who created the department. Later on, Crawford Young would have shaping aspect of that as well. By that time, by the way, I knew I couldn't go back to Uganda because of Idi Amin. The State Department had made the decision at that time that it was closed anyway. But by this time, Jordan was really, you know, having an influence on me. And he was teaching me my first African language, Xhosa, and told me that I wasn't very keen to go to South Africa under apartheid. But he said, how are you ever going to teach about Southern Africa if you're not there. And also, he convinced me that the oral tradition in South Africa was still very much alive and vital. So that's so I took a variety of courses here, but early on had set my sights then on going to South Africa to do my research for my PhD.
Okay.
And started to making arrangements with visas, because they were very hard to get study visas for South Africa under apartheid. They were very nervous about scholars coming to South Africa. But I think they decided that I was a harmless folklorist, and you know, whatever. They gave me a study visa. That's after I finished my studies here in the department. While this is going on, Madison is in upheaval. First of all, the civil rights movement had affected this university very much. That's before I came here. And then I come in the mid-60s, and the anti-Vietnam War process is going on, and it is very intense here. This university and Berkeley were the two major leaders in the anti-war movement, and I became involved in that as well. Marched, this department, I think, was the first department that refused to have classes as long as there were soldiers with bayonets on this campus.
And that was 1969?
So now that's, I think it's earlier than that.
Earlier than that?
Because I think I'm in South Africa in 1969. So I would guess that to be around 1967, somewhere around that. Because I'm in South Africa when Martin Luther King is assassinated.
Uh-huh.
And
that's 68.
Yeah, and then on into 69. I think that's the way it was, 68, 69. I was also there when they had the big... what they call it, a major, I think right down here in the middle of part of the campus, what was the name of that? It was some company.
Oh, the Dow?
The Dow Chemical thing. I was in South Africa at that time, too. But I was here when Sterling Hall was bombed.
Oh, okay.
I was in Madison at that time. But it was an incredible time here. Bascom Hill would be packed with students. It was a time of oratory, and then on University Avenue, these National Guardsmen with their bayonets, on these guns, all over the place, coming in, they tried to keep students from going to classes. I objected to that. I said that I did agree that when the soldiers with bayonets came, that was pushing it too far, that they really had to get off this campus. But there was tear gas everywhere. I lived over on Pinckney Street on the lake, and I couldn't go into my apartment sometimes, even there, the tear gas. There was tear gas in the churches, because that's where people would hide out. Coming down State Street early in the morning, the windows would be, in so many stores, would be broken. Some students didn't attend classes. It was a time when grades, some professors did not give grades below C for fear of sending students to Vietnam to go into the army. Mm-hmm. So there, grade inflation, not only here, it happened all over the country. So it was a very tense kind of a time on this campus. I think that the administration had a tough time during this period, deciding, what was going on, which side to be on, because the mayor at that time, Dyke, I think his name was very opposed to what was happening on the campus. The sheriff's office was very much opposed. They were all over the place, the sheriff's people and the local police. The city was divided against itself. A lot of parents, I understand, didn't want their kids to come near this campus because it was such a commie outfit. But it was a very heady, very exciting time. Once again, students felt that it was in their control to shape the nation. They were going to be disavowed of, this would go by the wayside later on. But as with the civil rights movement, so also with Vietnam, young people had the feeling that they could change the world, change the nation. It was a very exciting time. Now we know it wasn't possible, but they did have an impact, maybe not to the extent that we would have liked, but there was an impact.
I just as an aside, did you read David Moranis's They Marched in the
Yes.
Sunlight?
Yes. Right. No, that's what it was. Yeah. And then that wonderful movie that was made about Madison.
The War at Home.
Yeah.
Based on Bates.
Yeah.
The Rads.
Yeah. So, you know, and then ugly things happened, like Sterling Hall, which really put the end to it.
Yes.
You know, when Sterling Hall was bombed, it was just too much. The killing of an innocent person, I think that drew everybody back, because that's not what people were really struggling for here, was to kill somebody. I think that just like what happened in Ohio with the National Guard.
Kent State.
Kent State. You know, these were sort of seminal moments.
Yes.
Maybe they occurred at times when there was going to be a shift anyway. But by the end of the 60s, early 70s, it was pretty much over. I still remember walking across campus. That's when I got one of these Sony radio the things I put in my ear, listening to the Nixon trials and so forth.
Uh-huh.
It was just an amazing amount of history jammed into those few years in the 60s and the early 70s. My education here, my PhD education, was very much a part of that as well. There's no question. Again, as happened in my life, you could never separate what you were doing intellectually from what was happening outside of you. I don't think that at any point since the 60s, and maybe now in the 90s, things calm down so the students can have a life at a university where they can divorce themselves from the outside world. I don't know if that's possible. It sure as heck wasn't possible then.
Gerald, I have to ask you, when I think about you being one of four children, are you the only one in your family who was aware and have pursued attention to the issue of separation and differences? Or were all your brothers observant, or are you the odd one?
Yeah, I think I was the odd one. I think that my brothers became all sympathetic to what I was doing. But I had one of my brothers told me recently that he doesn't know me. What happens? You separate. You get separated.
Yes.
And it's really true. I went my own way, and I did maintain contact. Since my parents have died, maybe not. We still get along and so forth. But for a while there, I did know all my nieces and nephews. I don't think I know them all now.
Uh-huh.
I'm embarrassed to admit that. I think my brothers were always. I know my brothers are always sympathetic to what I believed in and so forth. Ken, he said, I don't know you anymore. And it's really true. We went our separate ways, and this is what happens. So I think that I was the most actively engaged in these kinds of things.
It's just interesting to me. I mean, you observed the world, and then you proceeded to understand it, and I think develop a philosophy, this one world philosophy.
There's no question. And at the same time, all this is happening, right from a very early time, I'm reading voraciously. Just reading. What happens? I'll maybe talk about this later on, but for a part of my life, a great part of my life, I'm very active. Part of the most active part of my life is still to come. But then when I came back from South Africa in the 80s, something happened. I had already made a decision that later on in my life that I would work collecting materials early, and then the second part of my career, I would write it up.
Oh.
And it's not as dramatic as collecting it, as I will point out, but something else happened to me, and it became logical. I really moved more and more into myself, and travel was not as important to me anymore.
Uh-huh.
The it was really I really moved, and I'm not quite sure I fully understand this, into the aura of ideas, and so you know, I'm quite content to be by myself. Uh-huh. I do a lot of reading. I go to concerts. I go to things like that. But it's something happened at a stage when I had all these experiences. And I think that I'm evaluating them internally and thinking about them, still reading, still thinking, but a major change happened. I'm not sure I fully understand how that works, but something did happen at that early stage. I'm still, I'll be 74 in a week. I never see myself. I just cannot see myself going into retirement and golfing, or you know, or playing shuffleboard or whatever people do. There's the activity is still there.
Yes.
But it's a different kind, in some respects, a different kind of activity. But I think I've been preparing for it all of my life. But anyway, to go back to Wisconsin and A.C. Jordan, he was magnificent. I did try to occupy too much of his time because I was so entranced by this wonderful person. But he gave me a lot of his time and a lot of his energy and a lot of his patience as I was learning the language. And, you know, the folklore is that to learn a language you have to be 5 years old. And, you know, I wasn't 5 years old anymore when I started learning Xhosa. And so it was with a certain amount of trepidation, you know, that I was working on that language. I studied it for 2 years under Jordan, and that's when I went to South Africa. All the problems with visa had been worked out, I thought, and I was, you know, going to South Africa was a real adventure for me, and I was excited.
69.
I was excited about that. Yeah, 67 now.
67, you went.
67 or 68, right? Anyway, the late 60s. 67. And I still remember landing at the airport outside Johannesburg, and I was completely on my own. You know, Professor Jordan had been absent for such a long time, and the areas where I was going to work, he could vaguely give me a couple of names, but you know, I didn't have any ideas of what was going to happen. I mean, I was really going into this. I did what graduate students are supposed to do. I touched base with universities, and they all told me, it's too late, you're not going to find anything. All the experts.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't get any real, from Wits, Wit Wadersrand, from Cape Town, later on from Rhodes University. I got no encouragement at all. And so, you know, what I did was, I still can't believe I had a general idea. I was going to go to the Transkei, where the Xhosa live, and I was going to go to Zululand, among the Zulu, and if I had time, I would go to Swaziland to work among the Swati, and then maybe the Ndebele people in southern Zimbabwe. Those are the four people who make up the Nguni language class. And I wasn't quite sure what was going to happen with the language yet, because I was going to areas where nobody spoke English. So I went to Johannesburg and enjoyed Johannesburg. I went to looked at some of the gold mines. Some of the people took me around. I met some people. They took me around, showed me the conditions of the gold mines, where Africans worked in the gold mines. Went to Pretoria, which was the bastion of, yes, of the apartheid people. It was really a very forbidding place. But on the other hand, it was, you know, I went to... the cities were closed to Africans at night. The Africans would be taken on buses or trains and taken back to the locations, as they called them. And so I was really getting a sense, slowly, of what apartheid was like. But you have to keep in mind that a lot of Americans and Europeans would go to South Africa, and they wouldn't think there was any problem at all. Because if you go to Johannesburg and Cape Town and Durban, you know, you can be in areas where you don't see, you know, you see Africans, but they're, you know, waiters and that sort of thing. And so, you know, as Barry Goldwater said when he went there once, He said, I've been here for a week and I haven't seen a Bantu, which is what they called the Africans at that time. Africans, the word Bantu means people in African languages, but the government officially used Bantu to refer to African people, so the Africans hated it. So Goldwater uses that term. I've been here for a week and I haven't seen a Bantu who isn't smiling, he said. I remember that so well. You know, nothing. Anyway, so I went to Cape Town and I was preparing myself. I stopped in Frankfurt, Germany on my way, which grad students did who worked in Africa, to pick up a Ure tape recorder, UHER, because they were so much cheaper in Germany where they were made than they were in this country. Oh. $200 it cost me. And picked up some BASF tapes. I wasn't sure what the heck was going to happen. And Cape Town, and then took the, somebody urged me to get a sense of what things were like in some parts of South Africa, to take the what they called the luxury bus, which was a bus that went from Cape Town to Durban, and I was going to get off in the Transkei. It moves along what they call the Wild Coast, some of the most beautiful coastline imaginable, and it really is wild. There were a lot of shipwrecks traditionally in those areas. So you get on this bus, whites only, and all, you know, tourists on it, and there's an Afrikaner who speaks English, and he's going to be your guide. And the reason they people wanted me to see it was to hear the official sort of view. So this guy is telling about our Bantu and how we treat our Bantu and how the rest of the world, you know, doesn't understand how, you know, our Bantu are not, don't confuse our Bantu with your blacks in America. Our Bantu are not civilized and that sort of thing.
Oh my.
We get off, I remember very well, when we get into the Transkei, the bus stops. Everybody gets off the bus, their cameras at the ready. And about a block away, some women, obviously waiting for the bus, African women, come walking over to the bus. And as they're doing so, they take the upper part of their garment and lower it so their breasts are showing. This is stereotyped Africa, and this is what the tourists want to see. And they come over and they stand there. Click, 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 go the cameras. Going to take Africa home. And then the women are given tips. And that's the way the women, you know, make their money. And, you know, the whole time I was there, I never saw a woman, with her breasts, it's just not done. That's a Mediterranean climate anyway, cold. But this was the Africa that they know, that they wanted to see. And so it was one of these, it was a trip that was meant to cement this stereotype view of Africans. I got off in Umtata, which is then the capital of the Transkei. This is the Xhosa area. And again, had no idea what I was going to do. I had this map.